Today in the Ink Studs, our special guest will be Trina Robbins. She is a bit of an archivist of the history of women in comics, and she'll be joining us to discuss the history of women in comics. She has some great stories of some really pioneering ladies that did some great stuff all the way from the turn of the century till nowadays. Check it out. You've got a plethora of a wealth of knowledge of the history of women in comics.
I like plethora better than wealth.
Okay, a plethora. What got you into researching the role that women have played in comics,
well,
not only creatively?
I mean, first, I got into comics. I mean, I never really got, well, I did kind of get out of comics very briefly in high school and got back into them in like the late-ish, the middle, late 60s. When, like, everybody was getting into comics, you know, the Marvel Renaissance, as it were, with the new superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I had always drawn, and it seemed like, you know, there was this whole pop art thing that I wanted to draw comics. And at the time, it didn't occur to me that, you know, male-female, I didn't know it was a male thing or a female thing or anything. It was just, it was comics, right? But then, by the late 60s, when I was in the Lower East Side, and there was, like, all these guys doing underground comics, and also by the 70s, when I came to San Francisco, and it was still all these guys drawing comics, and I kind of was not being included, and they were telling me things like, well, women just don't read comics, and women never drew comics, and, you know, I got that for so long, I finally decided this is not true. This is not true, and I started researching and finding out just how many women have drawn comics. But, like, we haven't known about them before because most of the histories of comics have been written by men.
Mm-hmm.
And the men, when they write about comics, somehow ignore the women. It's not like they make a point. It's not like they say, oh, she's a woman, I won't write about her. It's more like a kind of a blinders. It's like they don't see the women.
It's a boys' club.
Yes. Yeah, but it's more than that. I mean, it's not a, you know, when the men are not writing about the women, it's not a conscious boys' club. It's subconscious. It's like they somehow don't see the women. They're not on purpose going, I'll leave her out. They're just not seeing her.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the early examples of women that were involved in comics? Because the history, when you look at older comics...
Well, at this very moment, I'm working on a full-color collection of the art of Nell Brinkley. Nell Brinkley was an absolutely gorgeous, she herself actually was very pretty, but the author was gorgeous. She drew, her period is about from 1907 to 1939 or 1940, and she worked for the Hearst Syndicate newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
She drew a daily column, which usually consisted of one picture, sometimes it was like several frames, and commentary under it. But then she also did a Sunday page, and the Sunday page started in about 1918, started almost like a serial, like those silent movie serials. You can tell she'd seen them, you know, the adventure serials, like the Pearl White series. But by the 20s, they had become what I call kind of like proto-comics. They didn't have panels, and they didn't have speech balloons. The copy was under the pictures, but they had continuity. It was all these different pictures arranged on a page that told a story in continuity. They were like early comics. There, Alex Raymond, when he did Flash Gordon, also did comics like that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It was panels. He did have panels, but the copy was underneath. There were no speech balloons, or in fact, a Prince Valiant was like that.
I was reading just last night, it's something that Chris Ware wrote about Toppler. I probably mispronounced the guy's name, but that was the description below the panels was really the before the use of word balloons.
Those were the earliest forms of comics. So that's what Nell Brinkley did. And her work, she was a superstar. I mean, you could buy Nell Brinkley hair curlers. You know, she sold product with her name, and there were at least three popular songs written about her. She drew these beautiful women that were known as the Brinkley Girls, and the Ziegfeld Follies actually had an act in which these chorus girls would dress up all in white with, like, black lines around them as though they were pictures, drawn pictures come to life.
Oh, that's neat.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like, real-life comic within this vaudevillian.
They would reenact her drawings.
That's great. That kind of reminds me of a little bit of like what the Winsor McKay was doing with his drawing, but in a kind of different aspect.
Well, what Winsor McKay did, of course, was he did early animation.
Mm-hmm.
This was real-life people pretending to be comics.
That's great. I never knew anything about her.
Well,
and that's just one of many.
Her art right now, and it should be out in 2009, published by Fantagraphics.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. And did she do comics pretty much up until the end of her life, or was it she retired? And
well, she finally retired, and it's like, you know, there are styles, and people go out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And like by the 30s, her style was kind of out of fashion. But then, you know, then... usually, unfortunately, by the time they're dead, but sometimes when they're still alive, they're rediscovered. Like, if you know too much about, or if you know much about art, if you've ever heard of Tamara de Lampica, who was like a superstar painter in the 40s, in the 20s through the 40s, really, and then went out of style, and was rediscovered in, like, the 80s. Luckily, when she was still alive, or Erte, if you ever heard of him,
no.
He was this great designer in the 20s. And then they kind of rediscovered him, I think, starting in the 80s again, while he was still alive, which is nice. It's nice when they get rediscovered while they're still alive. But in many cases, they're no longer with us, which is the case, of course, with Nell Brinkley.
Now, you've been involved in chronicling a couple of early women in comics, or I guess Silver Age, end of the Golden Age, Mary Severn and Ramona Fraiden.
Yes.
Why don't you tell people a little bit about those two ladies, because Mary Severn's
two wonderful women. I mean, there was a time when they were the only two women in mainstream comics, because at that point mainstream comics had just become completely superhero and it was totally boy oriented, and most women are simply not interested in overly muscled guys with big chins and thick necks punching each other out. This is not of interest to girls, and most women really, because they don't like it, they have a hard time drawing it. I mean, you draw what you like, you know what I mean? So there were only two women, really, who were able to do this, and that was Marie Severin and Ramona Fraiden. And they're wonderful women. I mean, I'm just, my life is enriched because I know them.
What were some of the works that they did?
Well, Marie Severin started actually in the 50s as a teenager. I think she was about 18, and she was doing like color and things like that, just little color correction. Well, no, she was actually doing the color at EC Comics,
mm-hmm.
which I know you know EC Comics. They did the Vault of Horror and the Crypt of Terror and all those, and they had like great artists working for them. And one of the people was her big brother, John Severin, and so I guess he got her the job at EC. Then she, when EC folded, I mean, we get really into complicated stuff like Seduction of the Innocent in the 50s and the anti-comics phobia when people were burning comics. I don't have to go into all of this,
no.
Do I?
No.
Good.
No.
Okay.
I want to talk about the women.
But anyway, EC folded because of all of that, and she looked for work and eventually found work at Marvel. But at Marvel, she was just doing, like, production stuff. She was doing color. She was erasing pencil lines and stuff. She wasn't drawing. And then there was that whole renaissance, that superhero renaissance of the 60s that I told you about. And Esquire magazine wanted to do something about comics based on the Marvel superheroes. So they went to Marvel and they said, well, one of your artists, do this job for us. And all the guys were too busy drawing the Hulk and Spider-Man, and they didn't want to do it. So Marie said, well, I'll do it. And she did this great job. That was really her first. That was what, and you know, what brought her to the prominence. Martin Goodman, who was the publisher at Marvel, looked at this, and he said, hey, she can draw. He said to Stan Lee, he said, give her work. So Stan Lee did, and that's how she wound up drawing for Marvel.
Now, Ramona was on the other side of the town, I guess.
Ramona was working for DC, and there was a time neither of them had even met each other. They didn't meet each other until years later.
Were there any other women that were as actively involved as the two of them, or were they pretty isolated examples?
Were totally isolated.
Now, looking at the history of active women in comics as creators, would the Underground be the first kind of big example of women being heavily involved in the comic process?
Absolutely not. In the early 20th century, there were lots of women drawing comics in the beginning. Before comic books, they were drawing comics for the newspapers. There were tons of them. That's the point of my book.
Yeah.
And then in the 40s, when during the war, when all the young men went off to overseas to fight, the women filled their positions. And you had more women working in comic books than ever before.
I didn't know about that part of the...
Yeah.
Just like
any other field, I mean, you know,
yeah,
that the women went to work in the factories during the war. The women were driving the buses and trucks. They were doing all the jobs that the men had vacated. So they also worked in comic books. and there were more women working in comic books than ever before. And it's very interesting because what they drew in a major part were action heroines. They drew women, strong, powerful, beautiful women, girl detectives, jungle girls, aviatrixes.
What were some of the creations that they came up with at that point that would stick out as like
well,
really strong?
Well, my favorite publisher from that period is Fiction House Comics. And even though all the publishers had women working for them, Fiction House had more women than any of the other publishers. And they had it. They had like different comics that each had a different kind of a theme. So that there was one called Wings Comics, and that was all about flying. And for that one, there was this heroine named Jane Martin, and she started out as a nurse. But very soon she became a flying nurse. She was an aviatrix, a nurse who was an aviatrix and fought the Nazis. And she was drawn by Lily Renee in the beginning, and later she was drawn by Fran Hopper. And Lily Renee is an interesting person in her incredible, first of all, an incredible artist. She also, during the war, during the 40s, drew for another book, also Fiction House, a book called Fight Comics. She drew this heroine named Senorita Rio, who was a Brazilian counter-spy fighting the Nazis in Brazil. And, you know, her, in her alter ego, she was a beautiful nightclub singer. But Lily Renee, let me tell you about her. She was a refugee, a teenager, a Jewish girl from Austria who escaped the Nazis. And it's a long, complicated story. It's like something out of a book, Cavalier and Clay.
That sounds fascinating.
Oh, my God. By the way, the static is getting worse.
I'm sorry.
But anyway, she eventually, I mean, by way of England, she eventually got to America. And there she is living with her refugee parents, you know, scrabbling for work. Even though, I mean, her father had been very well off. He had managed this big steamship line in Austria. But, of course, they lost everything. And she was an artist, and she saw this ad saying that Fiction House Comics wanted a cartoonist. She's 19 years old. She's never drawn a comic before. She goes to the newsstand and buys a couple of comics and sees what they look like and draws a couple of sample panels, goes to Fiction House Comics, and she said she was sitting there. Everybody else there was a man, and they were all looking at her. She was very beautiful, by the way. She looked like Hedy Lamarr. She was gorgeous. And they were all staring at her. And the art director must have thought she was cute, you know? Because he said, well, he looked at her work, and he said, well, I'll give you 2 weeks, and if you work out, we'll keep you. And, of course, she was so good that she did work out. So she became their star woman cartoonist. They had a number of others, but she was the only one who did covers for them. And she is still with us. That's the wonderful part.
Really?
She lives in New York. She's this very gracious, elegant, intelligent woman. She's marvelous.
Did her involvement in comics get her interested in doing any other forms of art after the...
Oh, yeah. Well, she was an artist in general. And after she left Fiction House, which was, I think, like the late, maybe 1949, she illustrated some children's books. She did just regular illustrations and some fine art.
Were there a fair amount of women that were involved during the war effort times that stayed in the comics?
You know, what happened in comics was exactly what happened in every other industry. The guys came home and they wanted their jobs back. And the women were moved out of the jobs and back to the kitchen. They were encouraged. In the cases of, like, you know, the factories, they were simply given pink slips. You know, they were, that was it. That was the end of their work. In the cases of comics where everybody was a freelancer, they just weren't given work anymore. They weren't fired because they were freelancers, but there was just no more work for them. The work all went to the men.
How was it doing this investigation? Because you're researching into a lot of comics that are impossible to find, I'm presuming.
Nothing is impossible.
A lot of work.
A lot of work, did you say?
Yeah, a lot of work
yes,
to find some. What was, like, how did you really get into investigating these women at a time that there really isn't a lot of record of what they've done?
But there is. I mean, if you look through the old comics, you find work by all these women. And then, of course, I mean, that was just the beginning. Because then this really interesting thing happens, and that is that people find out what you're doing. Well, actually, my first book came out. My first book on women cartoonists came out, and then...
And what was the name of that one, just so we can plug
the
it?
The very first book which I wrote along with Cat Ironwood, was called Women and the Comics. But that book came out in like 1985 and went out of print extremely quickly because it was published by Eclipse, and they were in Guerneville, California, and all the books were in their basement. All the ones that hadn't, the book had just been published, and all the ones that had already been ordered went to the bookstores, and the others were in their basement, stored in their basement. And then what happened was the great Guerneville flood of 1985. And all of the comics in their basement were turned into paper mache. So that was the end of Women and the Comics, which means that it's scarcer than hen's teeth to find. And it went out of print, you know. If you blinked, it was gone. But once that book was out, people saw it and contacted me and said, you know, my mother was a cartoonist, or my aunt was a cartoonist, or I used to work for this cartoonist. You know, and I found... They just contacted me.
That's great.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting the evening come, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away. Watching the tide roll away, just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I've had nothing to live for, look like nothing. Watching the tide roll away, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me.
So during the 50s, really, there wasn't a lot. It was mainly...
The 50s was a low point. In the early 50s, there were still some women drawing comic books, drawing for the romance comics, because it was like almost like, well, that's an okay subject for women. We'll let women draw the love comics. And, of course, they were very good at it because they were really good at drawing beautiful women and great clothes and evening gowns and handsome men, you know. So so that went on, like, maybe through the early 50s, but... Soon, even that dried up for them.
Well, those were very popular at a certain point.
They were so popular. There was a time when they were the when love comics were the biggest selling comics in the industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a friend that's a thorough collector of romance comics. He and his wife, and it's pretty neat to see all the different weird topics and.
Oh, I love them! I have a huge collection. I love them.
And the later they get, some of the. The odd love triangles with the new hippie guy.
Oh, those are weird. Yeah, when they try to... you know, they were on their way out already because, I mean, times had changed and, you know, the stories were very passé at that point. So they were trying to keep up with the times. And those stories are some of the, they're either the most funny or the most embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just shows no clue of the social reality.
No, I mean, they're written and drawn by 40-year-old men who do not have a clue as to what, you know, the new generation was about.
How did the women's movement change how women understood comics?
Well,
or is that a lofty question?
Started, you know, what we call it second wave feminism. It's what they used to call women's lib. It started really in the late 60s and early 70s. And at that point, mainstream comics was totally male-oriented. It was all superheroes. And there were very few women in the underground.
Mm-hmm.
But that changed very quickly. Really, 1970, the very first all-woman underground comic book came out in 1970.
Which,
and I produced that book.
What was
it? It was called It Ain't Me, Babe. And I produced it in conjunction with the first feminist underground newspaper on the West Coast. They were based in Berkeley. And they were called It Ain't Me, Babe, named after the Bob Dylan song. By the way, this static is awful. Can you hear me?
You're sounding fine.
You sound terrible. Sorry about that.
I know, it's college radio.
But anyway, so that was the very first all-woman underground comic. And within 2 years, by 1972, we started Women's Comics, which was the first ongoing all-woman anthology. And Women's Comics lasted for 20 years, and it really opened the door for comics by women. And by the time, you know, when Women's Comics started, it was a core group of 8 women. By the time it ended, there were so many women, I can't even count how many women were doing comics by 1992 when we had our last issue.
I've got one issue of women's Comics at home, the one with the, I guess it's the centennial issue? The bicentennial issue?
Oh, yeah. I did the back cover of that one.
And it's really fascinating looking, because there is so many incredible talents in there. Some I know, some I don't. Like, I think Sherry Flanagan might be in that one.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure she... Oh, yeah. She did the cover.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse Ross.
And it's fascinating. It's just so much stellar talent. One thing, I interviewed Melinda Gebbie last year, and she mentioned during her time there is... It did definitely feel like a separation between the men and women in the comics field.
Oh, there was. I mean, most of the women in women's comics weren't being published anywhere else.
One thing you were published in the pseudo underground was the comics book. How was that for you, being involved in the?
Oh yeah. That was
Dennis Kitchen
edited it, and Marvel published it. That was amazing. That was amazing. For a moment there, we all thought that we were going to get rich. You know, because Marvel paid so much more than the Underground, but I think it lasted how many issues?
The Marvel published 3, and then he self-published the last 2.
That was it?
That
was the end of the dream.
5 of them. But your story was Panthera.
Panthea.
Panthea.
Uh-huh.
I misspelt it when I wrote my notes. That story, is that kind of a throwback to your own early interest in comics and some of the suspense? You're talking earlier about the serials and stuff. I kind of get that feeling of that 1930s serial.
Well, I definitely like adventure stories. And I didn't realize until recently I've recently written a paper and delivered a talk on this subject. It's going to be in this magazine called Proof, and it's very specific. It's about the feral women characters in the comic strip Lil Abner. I don't know if you know much about Lil Abner. It's a great strip. It takes place in Dogpatch, which is like the southern mountains, you know, and everybody's these just awful, degenerate, stupid hillbillies, you know, really grotesque creatures. But then there's these feral women characters, the most important of them being Wolfgang, who lives with wolves. And they're bloodthirsty because they eat people, but they're also beautiful. And with the exception of Daisy May, who's in love with Lil Abner, the only other beautiful characters are these feral women. And I didn't realize until later that, of course, I've got this fascination with feral women because Panthea is a feral woman. It's like, duh, you know?
What sticks out about the feral women then? Is it the strength of the characters?
Well, yeah. I mean, especially, again, Wolfgang, she's strong and she's also smart. She's smarter than the denizens of Dogpatch.
What were some prominent, because you've done books on female characters in comics, what are some really strong examples of characters?
Well, obviously, the first that comes to mind is Wonder Woman. I mean, I adored Wonder Woman as a little girl, and so many little girls loved Wonder Woman. She's not what she used to be. I mean, she used to be really a character that appealed to little girls, but as the years have gone by and little girls are not reading mainstream comics anymore, you know, her bra size has grown and her costume has shrunk, you know, so it's not what it used to be at all. But she's still an icon. She's an icon. I mean, you can get Wonder Woman, you know, Wonder Woman figurines and Wonder Woman calendars and Wonder Woman address books and Wonder Woman stationery. And women really love her. They love the icon, even though they don't read the comics. They'd be kind of horrified, I think, if they did read the comics.
What did you think of what Denny O'Neil did with her in the, was in the 70s?
Well, you know, I don't think that Denny realizes this. I think we do a lot of things subconsciously. But I know that men in the past, I've read so much that men have written about Wonder Woman, and they don't like her. They don't like her because she's threatening, because she's very strong. And I think that subconsciously what Denny was doing was disempowering her. He took away her powers, he took away her costume, he turned her into an ordinary person so that she wouldn't be threatening.
Okay. I was just curious of the your ideas on it.
Well, it was awful. Can you imagine doing that to Superman? The reaction you would get, the howls of protest? But he thought he could get away with doing that with Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm. Part of it seems like trying to take... Because did the characters seem less hypersexualized at that point?
No, not at that point. They didn't get hypersexualized till the 90s, really.
And they just made her the Uber woman.
Yes.
What are some other strong characters that just...
Well, you know, as a kid, I loved the Jungle Girls. Mm-hmm. There really are no more Jungle Girl characters, but they were so great. Talk about feral women. I mean, they lived in trees, you know, they wore leopard skin. They usually had a pet. I mean, like Sheena, who is the most famous, Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, she had a pet chimpanzee. I mean, what little girl wouldn't love to have a pet chimpanzee?
Well, I know Pia Guerra, who did Why the Last Man, was very happy. They did a final party for the last issue, and they had a chimpanzee at it, and she was very happy to see it.
Well, there you see.
I don't know if it was a chimpanzee, but it was a little primate nonetheless.
Uh-huh.
So, I wouldn't mind a pet one, but I don't think I'd want to clean up the poop.
No.
No.
No, that's why they put them in diapers.
Yeah. You still have to clean up poop, though, and diapers.
That's true. You do have to change the diapers, don't you?
Now, Art Spiegelman, there's this one thing he's quoted of talking about during his Comics 101 speech, and I forget where I read it, but someone's writing about how he was saying one of the biggest impacts of comics in the 70s was from women with their different styles, drawing different ways of looking at things.
Said that?
Art Spiegelman.
Ah, that's nice of him.
What do you think about that? Do you agree that women
had a different style from the guys? I mean, we didn't draw like the guys, and we didn't think like the guys, and we didn't tell the same kind of stories. And that did open up the comics field because, you know, for the past 20 years since the 50s, there hadn't really been a woman's viewpoint in comics.
I read somewhere that I think Aline Kaminsky was the first autobio cartoonist as well.
I think she was.
And that's something most people don't really realize. What were some challenges of the underground comics era for women?
The biggest challenge was getting published. That's why women's comics was so important.
Mm-hmm. And actually, for people interested in checking out, I know that they are still available from Last Gasp.
Yes, they are. Plus, of course, there's always good old Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm. Do they have the separate issue women's or just, I don't know.
I think they have women's comics, and eBay certainly always has women's comics. People are always selling women's on eBay. And, of course, you can go to conventions. Well, it's a little harder to find underground comics, old undergrounds at conventions.
I can't. When I find them, they're ridiculously overpriced.
Yeah.
It's like, oh,
don't
I
don't pay those prices.
No. Just enjoy the comics.
Yes.
People should enjoy it. Was that a challenge? Like I was talking earlier about the expensiveness of finding the old underground, of the Golden Age comics. The ones that were by women, it sounds like they weren't Marvel, they weren't DC, they were smaller companies, so that make it easier. Were they considerably less expensive?
There were a couple of women working for Marvel in the Golden Age. There was this one great superheroine character named Miss America, I love her. She didn't last very long, but she was great. She was a teenager, and she wore cat's eye glasses, which made her, I think, the only superhero in glasses, which is really cool, since I wear glasses. I like that. And she was drawn by a woman, and it's killing me that I can't remember her name right now. I can't remember the name. I'm sorry. I would have to run to my bookcase and open up my own book and find the name.
We'll have it as a postscript on the website. Yes. For people to check out.
Yes.
What were some of the other books? You have the history of women in comics, history of comic characters. You have a whole slew of different stuff.
Yes, well, I've written about women cartoonists and women superheroes, and then I wrote a book called From Girls to Girls. That last one is spelled G-R-R-R-L-Z. And it's a whole history of comics that girls and women have read, not necessarily drawn, although a lot of them were drawn by women, but it's comics for girls and women, because that's the other thing I used to hear all the time is girls don't read comics, girls never read comics. And I knew that was totally not true, you know?
One thing I find interesting is like, in the comics community, a lot of people try and, you know, see female comic customer and think, oh, comics, well, you're presumptuously going to pick out a couple titles that they would like, and I'm not thinking that's not going to be something they're into. So one thing I found is what works for women as readers is, I guess, a certain honesty to the storytelling.
Yeah, sure. Honesty to a storytelling works for everybody. Like, what do you mean? Like, don't talk down to them? Don't think, oh, you know, I'll simplify this for your pretty little heads. Is that what you mean?
not necessarily stating that, more that, maybe, I guess, a little, but just that the story's, you know, oh, it's about women characters, so you're automatically going to like it, you know, with
social insecurities. Well, I think that social insecurities. Women do tend to like books that star women characters, but it's got to be much more than just a woman character. I mean, I can't tell you how many times at conventions some guy has come up to me with his self-published comic and said, oh, this is, you'll really like this because it's got a strong woman heroine. But then it turns out the strong woman heroine has breasts the size of large balloons and is wearing like a thong bikini, you know?
That kind of...
And he doesn't get it.
Yeah, it just takes away from the point of the character.
Well, the point is that it's insulting to women, that these characters are insulting to women. You know, and it's not, you're not a strong woman character if you were a real life person, you would fall face forward, you know, because of the weight of your breath.
Well, that and massive back pain.
And not to mention, you know, just breaking off at the waist.
Yeah. I've seen some marvelous sketches where people drew what would actually happen with those physical proportions. So Girls to Girls, I've actually seen, that book is probably the one I've seen around by you the most. What were some highlighted titles that really spoke to people, other than Wonder Woman? Something that doesn't seem obvious.
Ones that are not obvious?
Yeah, something that, like...
Well, you know, there were all those teen comics in the 40s, and they were published, the best of them. Of course, Archie started it. The first teen comics were Archie. Archie started it in, like, 1945, I think. But very quickly, other publishers picked up on the fact that teen comics were really selling, and they sold really big. And my favorites were published by Timely Comics. And Timely is the company that eventually became Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan Lee was the editor in those days. And he wrote a lot of the comics, too. And they had, some of them were teenage boys, but most of them were teenage girls. And the two biggest sellers were Patsy Walker, who was this great typical teenager, and Millie the model. And Millie, in fact, lasted the longest. She lasted through the early 70s. She obviously was a model. It was like they had the teen girls like Patsy Walker, and there were others like Jeannie, and they all had girls' names, Cindy. But then they also had, it was like almost a career line, except that the comics were very lighthearted. But these were all career girls, like Millie the model and Nellie the nurse and Tessie the typist. And it was, I mean, you know, in those days, a girl couldn't aspire super, super high. But, I mean, just the fact that there were comics showing that she could have a career, even if it was just as a typist, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with being a typist, and there's certainly nothing wrong with being a nurse. This was really cool that they had these career girl comics.
It's, I guess it's part of the empowerment.
Exactly.
That the character,
it was like a girl reading this could look forward, could read this and think, well, I don't just have to, you know, get out of high school and get married and have kids. I could have a career, which was pretty revolutionary in those days.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking, yeah. No, I totally agree. What do you think of modern day comics? That do you feel that mainstream comics have kind of given up having women readership? And
They're still not exactly trying very hard for women readership. DC is publishing the Minx line, which is kind of charming. And that, of course, is, you know, they would never have had a Minx line if not for shoujo manga.
Mm-hmm.
That's what inspired them. I mean, what's really out there for girls is the manga that has just flooded this country. And most young girls who read comics, most teenage girls who read comics, are reading manga. And they're especially reading shoujo manga, which is the girls' manga. And the Minx line is, of course, inspired by that. But it's very smart of them. I mean, it's smarter than Marvel. I don't see them having any equivalent.
I don't think they ever will. And actually, the interesting thing about the Minx line is they're kind of picking and choosing creators for it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend that's working on one title, and
which one?
I can't remember the name. His name's Steve Rolston.
Can you remember what the story's about?
I know that the it hasn't been published yet. I don't think he's not done, or he is almost done. But like the writer of it is like a performance artist from Toronto.
Cool.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting, like going right outside of the box and getting, you know, a young woman that is doing something different.
Yes.
And doing an attempt at writing a comic, and the stuff I looked at is fantastic. I mean, Steve's he's one of those cartoonists who can take what he's got and doesn't make it messy. It's just really tight, perfect, minimal
nice.
Cartooning style. So
very nice.
He drew the most recent Escapist, based on the character, as you mentioned earlier.
Yes, of course.
Cavalier and Clay spinoff. Any comment on the change? Because I noticed that in the independent scene, in the alternative scene, there's such a much more prominent role that women have played recently.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there are more women drawing comics now than ever before, and that includes the 40s. But what they're doing, they're not, very few of them are working for the mainstream. What they're working for are the indies, or the self-published, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed what's interesting is actually a lot of big book publishers are starting to pick up.
Yes.
Specifically women doing comics.
Starting to understand the value of graphic novels. They're starting to see, you know, I mean, graphic novels can be carried in bookstores. They can be carried in libraries. Librarians are crazy about graphic novels because this is something that kids will read. I mean, readership is really way down, although it's always been more girls reading books than boys.
Mm-hmm.
But graphic novels is something that kids will read when they don't read books. And this is very exciting to librarians whose whole thing is to get people to read, you know. I spent much of 2006 and 2007 writing a whole series of educational graphic novels, many of which were aimed for classrooms. Of course, they were for kids of both sexes, but a lot of them were aimed specifically for girls because they were biographies of famous women like Bessie Coleman, who was the first African-American woman in America to get her pilot's license back in 1926. Or Florence Nightingale, we all know who she is, or Elizabeth Blackwell, who was the first American woman doctor. You know, and so these are like really great inspirations for kids, and I was pretty lucky in that I got really good artists that I had requested, which you don't always get an artist to request, you know.
Do you know about what Françoise Moulet is doing right now?
No, I don't.
She's doing a specific line of comics for younger children that are learning how to read as part of the function, the education function.
That's great. She's really doing these for classrooms, too?
I don't know if they're classrooms specifically. It's the line is called Toon Books, and it's based on her own experience with teaching her children how to read, of what worked and how comics worked. And then she went to schools and brought comics and worked with the students of what comics worked and what comics didn't. And it's quite fascinating.
That's great.
And there is actually some young women and older women that are involved in that. Someone that's never been published by a mainstream publisher before, and someone that's, you know, been doing books in France for 60 years. So
that's wonderful.
So highly recommend checking that out.
Yeah.
I think I'm pretty much at the end of my time slot because I'm going to mix in music afterwards. So thank you so much, Trina, for joining me. You have
it was fun. Plus the static is gone again.
Don't know what it is. It just comes and goes. I'm not
touching
anything.
Obviously, you'll be able to get rid of it. It couldn't possibly be on the radio with all that static.
It doesn't show up. It's just you getting it. It doesn't show up in the final recording because I've had other people having problems. So you have the one book coming out for Fantagraphics. Anything else people can look forward to?
I just got finished adapting Little Women into graphic novel form. That's going to be illustrated by Ann Timmons. Ann and I have worked together a lot. You may know that we do an ongoing title, and we're lucky if it comes out once a year, but it's ongoing, called Go Girl. That is very, very much, I mean, adults read it, but young girls really like it. It's about a teenage superheroine who can fly. And Ann is illustrating Little Women, and that's going to be full color. That'll be out sometime probably in 2009. I'm about to start another graphic novel for kids, but I haven't signed a contract, and I don't want to even, that's bad luck.
Yeah.
Don't talk about anything if you're not, but it'll be great. It'll be great because I love my story. I love the story that I submitted.
Now, the graphic novels that you did for schools, have they also ended up in libraries as well?
Well, I'm not sure about libraries, but I know that they're on Amazon.com, so that must mean that they're available.
Well, there you go. Check them out, Amazon.com. And your website is Trina Robbins with two B's.
TrinaRobbins.com with two B's, yes.
I'm a Robin with only one B.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make the distinction. Sometimes people think I have a Y and no Y.
Well, you'd be amazed at the way people have spelled my name. Mm. I mean, really, it's not like it's a hard name.
No. No, I understand.
I bet.
Thank you so much, Trina. And
will this be available on the internet or anything?
It'll be played live on, well, not live, but it'll be played on air on Thursday, like the date we originally, the date I sent to you. And then that day, it'll also be available online. And then I have every interview I've ever done archived on the website.
Great,
so
because I want to be able to send people to it.
Definitely, and check out some of the other women that I've had on this
month. I will. It sounds really great. Will you send me the link?
Yep, and next week I'll have Dinah Schutz on, which will be an interesting conversation.
Say hello for me.
I will. Thank you so much.
And remember the hello for David, for George.
For George, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got to meet up with him soon and give him some stuff, so I will definitely pass it along.
Okay, cool.
Thanks, Trina.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Go away from my window, leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone who's never weak but always strong, to protect you and defend you, whether you are right or wrong. Someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. Go lightly from the ledge, babe. Go lightly on the ground. I'm not the one you want, babe. I will only let you down. You say you're looking for someone who'll promise never to part, someone to close his eyes for you, someone to close his heart, someone who will die for you and more. But it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. Go melt back in the night. Everything inside is made of stone. There's nothing in here moving, and anyway I'm not alone. You say you're looking for someone who'll pick you up each time you fall, to gather flowers constantly, and to come each time you call. A lover for your life and nothing more. But it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe.